From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Elizabeth Klein's book is about the real cost of fast fashion. That's the super trendy clothing you see at malls. And the prices are crazy for this stuff. They whip consumers into a frenzy, but they don't have much of a shelf life. They're cheap, price-wise, quality-wise, too. And Klein says there's another cost for this cheap fashion. To the environment, to society, it's changed the idea of craftsmanship and our sense of style. Klein used to buy tons of these kinds of clothes, and aside from feeling bad about the social consequences, she said it made her stop liking her clothes. It's part of what the book is about, too, how clothing is supposed to have more meaning and more longevity. Her book is called Overdressed. She'll join us to talk about it after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You ever feel overwhelmed by fashion? You want to look nice. You don't want to spend a ton of money, but you want to keep up. And it just seems impossible. Hemlines and lapel widths and waist height and colors and patterns always changing. Forget about it. Well, the journalist Elizabeth Klein says that's probably never going to change. Fashion, she writes, is change. But the clothing industry has gotten itself into a predicament that is wasteful and unsustainable. And a lot of forces have played into this, economic forces that sent most of the manufacturing jobs overseas, and then those forces had consequences, social ones, environmental ones. And we're left with this trend of fast fashion. You see it at outlet malls and those trendy retailers, $5 t-shirts, $15 dresses, $10 sweaters. It's cheap. Cheap. And not just the price. A few years ago, Klein wrote this book about the cost of this fast fashion. And in it, she tells about this time she got all of her clothing together from her closet, from the bins and boxes all over the house, and she put them in a pile. And why did she do this? It started with a shopping spree, of course.
Before I cleared out my closet and kind of assessed what I had, I had this shopping trip that I guess I call my aha moment, my eureka moment, where I kind of realized that I had a bit of a shopping problem. I went to a Kmart in Manhattan and bought 7 pairs of $7 shoes. And the reason why I did this is because I, you know, the shoes were really cheap and I knew they were going to fall apart because they were so cheap. So instead of taking that money and buying a better quality pair of shoes, I just decided I'm going to buy all of these shoes in my size. And so every time they fall apart, I'll just have a backup pair to sort of fall back on. And I know this is a really extreme example, but for me, it just kind of made me really wonder what the impacts of the way that I was shopping might be, because they were completely hidden from me. And so the second sort of step in the process that led to the writing of the book was clearing out my closet, or getting everything out of my closet and putting it on the floor and really trying to figure out what I had and where it all came from. And what I realized was, first of all, that virtually nothing in my closet was made in the United States. Yeah. So everything was made overseas. I also realized that the average price point that I had paid for my clothes was probably less than $20 per item. And then the third thing that I noticed was that, you know, I had over 300 items of clothing. And, you know, just if you sort of extend that logic a little bit, you realize it's not possible to wear so much clothing. So I was wearing a very, very small percentage of what I owned.
And you write this, you realized you owned more clothing than you did anything else. And you knew the least about your clothes than anything else that you would purchase. You didn't know anything about this stuff.
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting paradox. That we live in this era of conscious consumerism where people know a lot, especially about food, and they're very engaged in the sourcing and manufacturing of the products that they buy, but they don't really extend that consciousness or mindfulness to clothes.
Yeah.
You know, we're still in this place where people aren't asking questions about, you know, does my T-shirt have an impact on the planet? Does my pair of jeans have a carbon footprint? Is clothing a recyclable? Who made my clothes? These are questions that we are just now starting to ask about clothes, that we already ask about a lot of other products, notably food.
Yeah. You mentioned in the book that for a while you only bought cheap fashion, and you're like a lot of Americans. Now, explain why. Why? What's the allure of that fast fashion?
Yeah, I think that I came of age at an interesting point. You know, I moved to New York City in 2002. Yeah. So it was like right around the time that fast fashion chains like H&M and Zara and Forever 21 were, you know, becoming a big deal in the States. And I watched my own consumption go from it changed really dramatically. So it was like in high school, I was mostly a thrift store shopper. Occasionally, I would buy something new, but for the most part, I really wanted, if I wanted something interesting, I would go to a charity shop or I would go thrifting. And with the rise of cheap fashion chains, the way that I shopped completely changed overnight. I stopped shopping in thrift stores. I stopped buying secondhand, and I started buying all new clothes. And it also really increased my pace of consumption. So that's when I started to notice that I was accumulating a lot of clothes. And what I quickly found out when I was working on the book was that the way that I was shopping was it's not extreme. Everything that I'm describing to you is typical of Americans now. You know, we're buying on average 60 garments and 7 pairs of shoes per person.
Per year?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that number has doubled since the 90s. We buy more clothing than any other country on the planet. And we also send more clothes to the landfill than any other country on the planet. So my point is that I'm not a shopaholic. I'm a typical American consumer.
Yeah.
And that's what I realized first when I started digging into the numbers when I was writing the book. I was like, oh my gosh, it's not just me. This is us. This is what is normal now.
Explain, if you would, what do we mean by fashion? Because I think some people are going to feel intimidated and maybe even some people uninterested in a conversation about fashion if that's all that we're talking about. I mean, fashion seems overindulgent. It seems too expensive. As you point out in the book, they're constantly changing the rules. It's just so daunting to try and keep up. So say something about that first, because you say fashion largely deserves its bad reputation, but so just that idea of fashion and the way we take to the idea.
Yeah, I think that Americans have a really complicated relationship to fashion. I think that we do write it off as vain and frivolous while at the same time spending a lot of money and time on buying it.
Yeah.
And, you know, fashion and clothes really are often synonymous. So it doesn't matter whether you're shopping in H&M for trends or you're shopping at Old Navy for basics. The fact is that we buy a lot more clothing than we need or can make good use of. And I see that I work in the secondhand clothing industry now, so I actually, you know, kind of dig through clothing donations. And it's not just women, it's men too. And it's not just people who are into fashion. It's people, you know, I see people overbuying T-shirts, overbuying cargo pants, overbuying workout gear, you know, things to wear around the house. It's that it's this extreme acceleration of consumption that I'm talking about. So this is a conversation that's important whether you say you're interested in fashion or not, because we all wear clothes.
Yeah.
And almost every single person in this country is buying a lot more clothing than they used to and throwing a lot more clothing away than they used to.
You say that when you were chasing trends with one eye on the price tag, as you used to do, you said that didn't get you any close to liking your clothes, which made me wonder, are we supposed to like our clothes? Because you say we're missing a connection to our clothes.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Like, that's the thing that has changed for me. In the years since I was researching the book, I didn't really know what having a connection to or a relationship with clothing really meant. I mean, it sounds kind of like silly. It's an inanimate object,
yeah.
But like it is something. Clothing is something that you can have a relationship with. And I think what it takes is slowing down and being a lot more intentional about what you buy. Because obviously you're not going to have a connection to something if your process for buying it was you walk into a store and you're like, I guess I like that. It's $20, whatever.
Yeah.
So part of it is, being more intentional. And then for me, I think what also fosters a relationship with clothing is being the person that like takes really good care of it.
Yeah.
And again, that goes back to what I've seen in the secondhand industry. I see people donate things that have covered in pet hair, lint, pills, food stains, things that are really easy to remove. I'm not talking about being able to do like complex mending. I'm just saying people don't even bother to care.
Yeah.
Care for their clothes. And caring for clothes is a really good way to sort of foster that relationship or that connection and to make you like clothes. I love clothes.
Yeah.
Like I could not say that when I was working on the book, and it's one of my greatest passions now.
You talk about these old-fashioned habits that we used to have, where you'd build a wardrobe over time, where you'd save up and invest in, a really great piece, patch stuff. Talk a little bit about, if you would, the way we used to think about all of this. Because you mentioned well into the 20th century, clothes were precious, I think, is the word you use for a lot of us. And we use them. We pass them down. We use them a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really easy to kind of look back and romanticize the way things used to be. I don't want to fall into the trap of kind of looking back at when clothing was a lot more expensive with rose-colored glasses. But, it 100 years ago, clothes were so expensive that we were spending about 20% of our income on them. And now we spend 3% of our income on them. And that's largely a reflection of how much cheaper clothing is. So
yeah.
We just, we don't have to spend as much of our income on it. And one could easily argue that that's a good thing. That's a great thing. It frees up resources to spend on other things. But yeah, it also has changed that connection again in the relationship. We used to shop more seasonally, and absolutely clothes were kept until they were worn out, falling apart, or you'd maybe hand them down to someone else. And then as sort of like a last resort, you maybe would use them as rags, cleaning rags around the house. So you really were kind of a steward of your clothing, and you saw it through its entire life cycle. And now there are consumer surveys that show that the average piece of clothing is only worn 7 times.
Wow.
So, yeah, I know. It's crazy. So if you think back to our grandparents, great-grandparents who, wore an item of clothing for years and years and years and years and years until it absolutely could not be worn anymore. A lot has changed since then.
That's Elizabeth Klein. Her book is called Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking fashion, clothing, the way we dress these days. The journalist Elizabeth Klein has written this book about how cheap we've all gotten. Cheap fashion, fast fashion. It's super trendy, but it's terrible quality-wise, and it has these costs. Her book is called Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. When you first wrote the book, the American clothing manufacturing base was pretty bad. It had plummeted year after year. And then when you wrote the book, 2% of clothing was made in the United States. Are we still about there?
It's gone up. It's actually gone up a little bit. I think we are at 3% now. Yeah. So there's been a little bit of a resurgence. And but I think that 1 percentage point, it's real and it's important. I think that especially since what I've seen is Made in America clothing representing quality and craftsmanship. So it's not just you're buying an American-made product. It's actually a different product. Right. It's not just your cheap mass-manufactured clothing. There's something different or special about it, and I think that's really interesting and neat. But yeah, when I was writing Overdressed, it was kind of at the tail end of this huge, huge loss of jobs in the apparel manufacturing industry. So in the decade ending in 2007, the U.S. had lost 600,000 apparel manufacturing jobs. It was this just like huge, huge wave of job letting. And I don't know if those jobs will come back in the same way. I don't know how realistic that is.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back to that actually, because I think that's a big question.
Yeah.
But what you explain in the book and you go through is what that means for the garment industry basically to go into decline, because you point out it contributed to the decline of domestic wages, the decline in the middle class. It was a contributor anyway. So it's had a broad effect on the culture, I guess, on the economy and society.
Yeah, because what we've seen, and you know, the loss of manufacturing jobs is something that we've been talking about as a country throughout the election season and currently with the new administration. It's it's a really important conversation, because really what we've seen is people that used to be in manufacturing moving over to the service industry or the retail industry. And those aren't necessarily bad jobs, but they're usually not as consistent. The benefits and pay aren't as good as manufacturing. But in the clothing manufacturing sector, especially in a garment factory, those jobs have always sort of like fallen in and out of being, sweatshop jobs. It's always been a struggle to make apparel producing jobs good jobs. And that was certainly true even when they were mostly here in the United States. And obviously it's been true now that they're outsourced to China, Bangladesh, other parts of Asia. I don't want to like sugarcoat that and say that, you know, when we had garment jobs in the United States, that they were all great paying jobs and that none of them were sweatshops, because that's just not true.
Yeah. I wonder, in order to shave costs, you talk about how fabrics, I'm really interested in the influence all of this has had on our sense of style, but also the quality of our clothes. Because one of the things that happened is fabrics have become thinner and lighter over the years. In fact, one designer that you talked to for the book told you that there are very few high-quality garments being produced at all anymore, and I'm wondering about that.
Yeah, so that's one thing that really really caught my attention and blew my mind in my research was like, so as what you can sort of like boil all of this down to is the garment industry or the fashion industry was globalized. And that happened around, you know, from the mid-90s when NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, was passed through 2005. And all of these other changes happened to the fashion industry at the same time. Basically, clothes went from being more of a sort of like craft-based, small quantity, small run item to this thing that was mostly mass manufactured in huge, huge factories overseas. So, you know, some of the designers that I talked to in the book that remember the industry in the U.S. from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, they would tell me, you know, that like a large run for any single design might be like a couple thousand units. Well, in China, the factories there, they won't make anything less, you know, than 10 or 20,000 per unit. And typically they want to make something that's in, you know, 10,000 units, 200,000 units. So We really kind of moved over to this system of mass manufacturing clothes with these huge economies of scale. So the point wasn't to make small batches of really beautifully made, high-quality items. The goal now is to mass manufacture, you know, gobs and gobs and gobs of clothes and make them at just barely high enough quality that the customer will still pay for the item, but it's definitely not something they plan on having their closet, having in their closet or wearing for more than like a couple seasons.
So what was the influence on our sense of style? Because you talk about how these big global clothing chains, what they try to do is take the risk out of fashion by selling the same, as you say, carefully crafted trends over and over again. So what has that meant for our sense, you know, what you see on the street and our sense of style?
Yeah, I think that, you know, for a generation of consumers, they actually have a hard time even identifying quality. You know, what does that mean? What does it look like? How can you tell the difference between a cheap fabric and one that has a good hand feel and has a sort of dynamic and rich texture? How can you tell something that's put together and well constructed? And why does it matter, you know, how the zipper is attached to the item or what the buttons are made out of? So for a generation that I would include myself in, even being able to recognize quality is a skill that sort of disappeared. It's gone extinct. And yeah, I do think that in general, you know, the mass manufacture of clothing has, of course, changed our fashion sensibility. You see just this mass, I guess what you could describe as like casualization of American fashion. Like we wear very simple clothes. We're very much like a jeans and top kind of country, or, you know, kind of like the whole athleisure thing is kind of big now. So people just wearing like workout, you know, like tights and a top. So I think if you look at it on a macro level, yeah, you see people wearing clothes that are less structured, less detailed, less tailored, all as a result of these changes and forces that we are describing.
It seems like it's been, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. Maybe I'm getting this wrong, but you started to see this trend toward more of a sense of quality for men. I'll just speak for men. My observation. Better fit. You know, people starting to dress up a little bit. Men, anyway. And I'm wondering, so it just makes me wonder if how the trends have changed a bit. And we'll come back to this also a little bit later, but if you're seeing things that make you feel more optimistic, that people might be paying more attention to quality and fit, or if that's really a trend at all.
I think you're right. I mean, we could spend just as much time talking about you know, as just as much time as we've spent talking about what's wrong with the fashion industry, talking about the really incredible and exciting things that are happening, you know, in terms of sustainable and ethical fashion. And as you're describing this renewed interest in quality and craftsmanship, and also I think that the minimalism trend has really helped in this department. So people are once again sort of fascinated with and taken by the idea of creating a wardrobe, and like capsule wardrobes are really big things. So that's, you know, committing to only having, say, 30 items in your closet, and they're all, you know, they all mix and match perfectly, and you can create an endless number of outfits out of them. So yeah, I think people are exploring these things, and you know, maybe some aspects of it are a trend, but I really don't think so. I think that this is the beginning of a massive shift in consumer preferences, and we've seen the same thing with food.
Yeah.
You know, like if you think about 20 years ago, like who would have thought that a lot, you know, most Americans would question the appeal of a fast food hamburger. And now, you know, the whole locavore, organic food movement is huge. And people being very particular about where and how they eat is a very real thing and a very big part of the market. And I think we're absolutely going to see that with fashion, and I think it's going to be driven by millennial consumers, and I think that older consumers are interested in it too, because they actually remember when the world wasn't like this.
Yeah.
You know, they can remember when things were made well, and most, you know, most of them miss it. They liked the way things were to a certain extent.
Yeah. It's how is it that Old Navy can sell a t-shirt for $8. What is it that makes this stuff so cheap?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And also like it's such an important way to frame it, because I think sometimes we get numb to the prices. Mm-hmm. Like maybe we think that it's normal. So there are a couple different kind of factors that go into an $8 t-shirt. First, which we've already, touched on, is the price of labor. I know that producing clothing domestically is, since you are talking about t-shirts, I saw Gildan and American Apparel said that it's 25% more expensive to produce a t-shirt in the United States right now. So it's actually the gap is getting smaller, because the cost of wages are going up in China.
Sure.
Anyway, I digress. Back to the question. So labor, you can pay someone about 50 cents to make a t-shirt in Bangladesh, for example. I think that the fabric choice is also a big part of it. Like if the price of cotton is too high, no problem. Blend in polyester because it's cheaper. Blend in viscose because it's cheaper. But then the third piece of it goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's the economies of scale. Yeah. If you make a million t-shirts versus 5,000 t-shirts, your costs as a company, as a brand, as a factory plummet. It just is so much cheaper to produce clothes at that volume. But the problem with that is exactly why the environmental footprint and the environmental toll of the fashion industry just continues to escalate, because clothes are being produced at such gigantic scale.
Elizabeth Klein, her book is called Overdressed. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Elizabeth Klein. Her book is called Overdressed. One part of what you've written about is you went behind the scenes at, I think it was Salvation Army, to sort of look at thrift stores. And this was surprising, I have to say. I mean, a lot of us feel good about donating all of the crappy clothes that we bought to Goodwill. But you found that it's a different picture than I thought. I mean, you found that there's just too many clothes for even thrift stores.
Yeah, yeah. The whole charity system, it's complicated. But the first thing I want to say about that is, you know, donating clothing to charity is a perfectly acceptable way to get rid of unwanted clothes. I don't want to mix messages on that point.
Sure.
But what I found was that, charities get so much used clothing that they're actually only able to sell about 10 to 20% in their own retail stores. And then the rest, they sell off to these other companies, these other textile recycling companies. And then they ship it overseas to other countries where there's a market for used clothes. The reason that happens is because we're simply generating far, far more used clothing than charities can handle. I was crunching the numbers actually before our chat, and something like 3 billion pounds of clothing get reused or recycled in the United States. So that's like the stuff that we actually bother to take to thrift stores or drop off in a donation bin or whatever.
Yeah.
That's something that's around 6 billion t-shirts. So this is one thing, like when we talk about like if you want to use the charity, oh, I dropped my clothes off at a charity, as an excuse for overconsumption, you just have to remember, like, the amount of clothing waste that we produce, we could clothe the entire homeless population in the United States with the amount of clothing waste that we create in 2.5 hours.
Wow.
So that's just how much unwanted stuff we're creating. It's really, really massive.
But what about those who go to thrift stores to find, you know, more durable clothes or clothes from another? Is that stuff even out there anymore? I mean, you know this part of the. I mean, I read men's style blogs from time to time and talking about thrifting, and you can find, you know, good old Brooks Brothers sack suits, for example. Or you used to be able to, and I'm wondering, can you even find that stuff anymore?
You can. So the industry, some people in the secondhand industry call that stuff the cream. And if you had to venture a guess, like, what would you say the percentage of good stuff is in the secondhand industry? Like, just if you had to guess.
Mm-hmm. What would I guess? 12%?
It's 2%.
Oh my gosh.
Sometimes as high as 5%, but that's basically anything that has any sort of resale value is 2%. You know, and most of what you see come in is Old Navy, Target, H&M, really low quality stuff. And and that makes the economics trickier for people in the secondhand clothing industry. It makes more sense to just pack it up and sell it off by volume, like by pound, as if it was like rice and beans or something. You know, let's just ship it overseas in a big one-ton bale for 70 cents a pound or something.
Yeah. One of the things that is, I'm wondering what you do about, and this seems like there's nothing you can do about it, and that is the fact that fashion is always in perpetual motion. Or as you put it in the book, fashion is obsolescence. Fashion is change. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that? I was thinking, for example, of the company, outdoor apparel company, Patagonia. And they are, on one hand, extremely responsible about their environmental, the environmental part. They outsource some of their clothes, or probably all of their clothes, but they're more careful about their fabrics and their practices. But their stuff changes every year. Their colors change every year. Their styles update every year. I mean, that seems like a weird conflict, and I'm wondering if there's anything that how are you thinking about that? What do you do about that?
Yeah, I think that the key is finding that happy medium because fashion is change, and that's one of the most wonderful things about it. You know, I see it as a sort of language. You know, trends sort of disseminate through, especially in New York, you can see how they spread slowly. I mean, really over a matter of days, you can see new trends emerge, especially around this time of year, and then they're just passed so quickly, and then they expire.
Yeah.
I think that we also have to remember that the fashion aspect of the clothing industry is also what makes it such an important economic engine. So it provides a lot of jobs all around the world, whether it's people working in retail or design in the United States, or it is the, you know, hundreds of millions of people who work making clothes in other countries. We don't just want fashion. We need it. We need it. It's an important part of the economy. And there are people in the ethical and sustainable fashion movement, and there are people at big brands who argue that the clothing industry can exist at the scale that it currently exists at and be operated. It could be done sustainably.
Yeah.
There is an argument to be made that we could do what we're doing and just make it a lot, you know, a lot better for the planet and a lot better for people. Yeah, it's just two different philosophies.
Yeah, but it always gets us to price. How do you deal with the price question? I mean, you know, people who. I mean, one of the things you say early on in the book is that you've seen guys in your local coffee shop and they have these really expensive laptops and yet they're wearing these cheap, you know, $10 Walmart shoes. and so on one hand, you say it's not that we can't pay more money for fashion, although there are plenty of people who can't, let's be honest. It's just we don't see any reason to. So maybe deal with that question of price. How much is too much to pay for clothes? It's a question you get to later in the book, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, I think, the reason why I think people are partially defensive about the price question is because you have designer and luxury brands on the other end of the spectrum who are overcharging for clothes. So people know, oh, if you're buying like a luxury handbag, it's marked up 13 times over the cost of production. So in a lot of consumers' minds, they see only two choices, which is cheap or overpaying for clothes.
Right.
So what I'm an advocate for is what used to be called the middle market, the sort of reasonably priced, fairly priced clothes that are in the middle. I think that when people say I can't afford to spend more on clothes, there's a couple of things going on. One, if you and as you were saying, like, of course, there are plenty of people who for whom that is absolutely true.
Sure.
But if you look at the way we spend money on clothes, we know that we spend 3% of our income on clothing. While buying more clothing than any other country and paying less per item than any other rich developed country. So what that points out is that for a lot of us, cheap is our preference. What we want to do is pay a very small amount of money and get a lot of clothing for it. So we would rather buy five $20 items than one $100 item.
Yeah.
That's the way that we shop. For most of us, $100 sounds completely crazy and outrageous to spend on a top or pair of pants or whatever. So I think it's cultural. I think it's cultural as much as it is financial and economic.
But how do you get by that? I mean, I know people who would drive cross town and spend $5 in gas to save 50 cents in laundry detergent. It's almost human nature. There's this weird impulse.
No, it's American. It's definitely not human nature. Okay. You can go to other countries and like you can go to other countries and they have, you know, a completely different fashion culture where it's not looked down on. The other thing is we sort of like judge people and think that you should feel guilty if you pay for clothes, if you pay good money for clothes. So I think one thing is like Going back to like how there's this new movement toward quality in the capsule wardrobe and all of that, like there are people in the U.S. who are trying to create this new culture that's like, you know, maybe I will skip that $20 top thing that I used to do this week and try and see what else is out there. Like maybe care a little bit more about quality or try and seek out an independently owned boutique or see if there's something that's a little bit more interesting and more unique. I mean, changing that starts with us, with consumers, and we have to want that. And I think there are so many different motivating factors. Like maybe you could be motivated by the environmental impact of the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could be motivated by the financial aspect of it because, you know, cheap clothes, what's the proverb? Like I can't afford cheap things. Like there's an argument to be made for investing in clothes that you're going to wear for years instead of just for a season. Because what we're doing right now is going out every season and just buying clothes that we're not going to wear for very long, and it is quite literally like a waste of money.
You tell this interesting story in the book. Several years ago now, you were in New York City, and you saw this dress at this luxury clothing store. Mm-hmm. And so you went in and checked it out, and it cost $7,000.
Mm-hmm.
Tell that story because I think there's an interesting lesson in here.
Yeah, so like the $7,000 dress, it's a good thing that the $7,000 dress exists. And because it's essentially art. Like if you really dig into how luxury brands create their couture and runway garments, I'm not talking about when a designer is trying to charge $400 for a T-shirt.
Yeah,
I'm talking about when a designer is creating a, you know, a very intricate garment made out of really exquisite materials. When you look at how much time, how much labor, how much expertise and skill goes into creating something like that, of course it's going to cost $7,000. And there's also the issue of going back to the economies of scale. Like there's probably, what, 5 of those dresses in the world? Maybe there's only 1 mm-hmm. of those dresses in the world. So fashion is really interesting that way that yeah, like a dress can be $7,000 and it actually cost that much to make it. And then a dress can also be $7 and it actually cost that much to make it. And it has everything to do with the labor involved, the number of pieces that are produced, and the materials that are used. And again, I'm an advocate for the mid price stuff. Like that's what I wish there was more of. There doesn't need to be more $7,000 dresses in the world.
Right.
But, you know, I would like there to be more reasonably priced, well-made products out there.
You're coming to Utah, a guest of a local business, Mabo Boutique. Emily McMaster is the owner. She's also founder of Mabo Children's Clothier, and she designs kids' clothes, and she sells them online, but also at this brick-and-mortar store here in Salt Lake. And so she designs this stuff in Utah. It's manufactured in Utah, also in Colorado. Anyway, but there, I wanted to ask you about her particular challenge. Like, think about, this is a local company for the most part. And there are a lot of challenges that she's having to deal with. And I'm wondering, what is it going to take for a business like Mabo to make it? Like, how much do you have to charge? How much are people willing? And at what point does she figure she has figured it out? Because it seems like that price point is a problem you have to deal with. And like, mm-hmm. what's the challenge for a local clothier, for example, to make it these days?
I think the challenge is, and I don't want to speak for her, but like, you know, when I think the challenge is when you have the store down the street is selling children's clothes or fashion or whatever for $10 or $20 and making the case for why your product is different and better. And also, I think just in the whole ethical and sustainable fashion world in general, there are a lot of small companies and startups. So it's like we're at the very beginning of this journey to create an alternative fashion industry. And when you start to see things really work is when you see companies like Everlane and Reformation. So they're both, for the most part, online only. Everlane is a fully transparent fashion company, and Reformation is one of the most sustainable fashion brands out there. And they both sell clothes at this mid price point that I keep talking about. So it's like maybe a top would start at $20 or $30, and then like everything would top out around $200 or $300 for the most like complex garment. They're really popular. I mean, we could dig into the challenges, but I think what's cool is that we're also starting to see success stories where brands have started to figure out that sweet spot where it's like quality, reasonable price point, maybe not cheap, but something that you can save up for and afford, fashionable and popular as a result.
Because that's another point you make in the book, that ethical fashion, local fashion, used to be kind of, you know, boring and drab, but that's but that's changing these days. You say that some of these slow fashion pieces they're really well designed, the quality is obviously there, and there's a good chance that they're going to be relevant years from now. So there's the trend, the style part of it will last longer, it seems.
Yeah, well, and I think, with Reformation, I don't think they're necessarily trying to create timeless design. So much has changed since I finished Overdress. Like, I am working on a ethical shopping and consumption guide right now because there's so many ways to do it now that didn't exist when I finished my book. But Reformation is very trend driven. So I think maybe the lesson that the ethical fashion movement learned early on is that you have to lead with design. People have to like the product, or it's nothing else is going to work. Because it's more successful when you sell someone an item that they really, really love. And then as they're walking out the door, you're like, by the way, that's organic.
Right.
Or, you know, like, just sneak it in there.
I wonder, what are the lessons that you convey to people about how to go about this? Well, I mean, one thing you write about is shop less, shop with more intention. I mean, what are the suggestions you give people?
I want to say first that a lot of this does fall on the shoulders of brands. They're the ones that really have to look at their supply chain and figure out ways to make it more sustainable, use less water, use less toxins in their dyes, less chemicals, and reduce their carbon footprint. So I want to make sure people know that it's the brand's responsibility, too. And that one of the easiest things you can do is communicate to your favorite brands, email them, tweet at them, post something on Instagram and tell them that this is something that you care about. And also when they do offer some sort of sustainable product or ethical product, which H&M does now, Urban Outfitters does, Zara, Levi's, Timberland, they all have ethical products, sustainable products. So if you're given the choice, consider buying that other option. And then, some of the easiest things we can do as consumers are to simply buy things that you know you're going to wear, take care of them, and then recycle or donate them at the end of their useful life. So never, ever, ever throw away clothes. They're almost 100% recyclable, even if they're not rewearable or reusable. And I think that's a pretty huge thing. I think that it doesn't mean you necessarily have to buy the organic product. It can simply be a shift in the way you think about clothes and treat and maintain your clothes. Like that's equally as powerful.
So what's shopping like for you these days?
Shopping for me, I don't shop nearly as much as I used to, which I guess is probably an obvious statement. But yeah, I have a really, really different relationship to clothes than I used to. I mean, I have a relationship to clothes, which I didn't have before. Right. And my closet is a mix of secondhand, you know, going back to how I shopped in high school, with one very important difference, which is that the secondhand industry has moved online. So it's like all these sites like ThredUp and Tradesy and the RealReal, all these resale sites didn't exist even when I finished the book. And they have made shopping secondhand, buying on-trend stuff for practically nothing so easy. Highly, highly, highly recommend that. I buy domestically made clothes when I can. It's not just blind patriotism or something. And if I'm buying something that's quality, I'm buying something that's really, really well made. So that's where I'll spend more money. You know, I'll spend more money on like a jacket or shoes. And then I try to be a little bit cheaper for everything else. But it's those pieces that get worn all the time is where I'm like less afraid to really make an investment.
Elizabeth Klein. Her book is Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.